Work.org. Welcome to Ask the Experts, our regular interactive web show that provides in-depth discussion of current health policy issues and allows you to interact directly with the nation's top policy experts. For the first time since the failure of the Clinton health plan over 13 years ago, the notion of comprehensive health reform is in the air. And at the heart of many reform plans is a requirement that some or all Americans obtain health insurance. On January 1, Massachusetts began enforcing such a mandate as part of its effort to provide universal coverage. The idea has made it into congressional legislation as well, and just yesterday a major business coalition endorsed the idea. On the campaign trail, candidates have sparred over individual mandates in both the Democratic and Republican presidential debates. Our aim here, in our usual too boring for C-SPAN approach, is to bring a reasoned and analytic discussion to this very contentious issue. And we're joined by three experts from across the ideological spectrum to do just that. Michael Cannon is Director of Health Policy Studies at the Cato Institute and a former Senate staffer. Sherry Gleed is chair of the Health Policy and Management Department at Columbia's Mailman School of Public Health. She previously served as a senior economist for the Council on Economic Advisers under Presidents Bush and Clinton. And Len Nichols, on the phone with us from Denver, is a health economist and director of the Health Policy Program at the New America Foundation. He earlier served as a senior advisor for health policy at OMB. You can reach our panel of experts in two ways. Email your questions to ask@kaisernetwork.org. Or call us here at the Kaiser Family Foundation Broadcast Studio and ask your question on the air. You can phone toll-free at 1-888-KAISER-8. That's 1-888-524-7378, and we'll try to get to as many of you as we can. Thanks to all of you for joining us. And Len, let me start with you on the phone from Denver.
Okay.
I want to start with some of the factors you and others as advocates for an individual requirement or an individual mandate point to as reasons to go in that direction. Let me start first the question of achieving universal coverage, since that's been a major point of contention on the campaign trail. In your view, is an individual mandate the only way, let's say, short of a single payer approach to get to universal coverage, to guarantee universal coverage?
I think it's absolutely necessary to cover all Americans if you want to do it in a market-oriented private insurance system. And you're right, the only other way is single payer. I think a lot of health economists would agree with me, and the Urban Institute just released a study today or yesterday confirming what I believe the health economic literature is pretty clear about, the responsiveness of people to price subsidies. If you go pure voluntary, even if you have fairly generous subsidies, you're not going to cover more than half of the uninsured. So basically, the reason to do a mandate is not because we like it. I mean, I would think of mandates as kind of like booster shots. They're vaccinations that sometimes hurt a little bit, but they protect you from the rest of us, and they protect the rest of us from far worse illnesses down the road. They actually make markets work better. It makes sure everyone pays their fair share. It reduces the severe adverse selection fear of insurers, which enables you to impose rules that make markets more fair. And part of the fairness rules, that is to say you can't charge people differentially based on their health status, will reduce the underwriting and selling costs that keep the cost of insurance so high, and fundamentally that makes it possible to have both more efficient and more fair markets with mandates.
Well, let me ask you, I mean, you compared a mandate to a vaccination shot to protect people from an illness or a disease. What is the illness that we're preventing here? I mean, what are the consequences of having what some people would call free riders? I mean, people that are outside of the system.
Well, what happens when people don't have health insurance, but they do have an emergency or a condition that reaches a level where they seek care, if they can't afford it, most of our provider institutions will try to give them the care that they have available to them. And they will charge the rest of us for that. So it shifts the cost on the rest of us. Now, for the low-income population, we have some programs that take care of that. But what we're trying to do with the mandate is have everyone pay their fair share. Roughly 20% of the uninsured in our country actually make more than three times the poverty level in income. So they could surely afford to pay all, if not most, of an insurance premium, and basically then by not requiring them to do that, the rest of us bear the cost of the uninsured.
And you also hit on the idea of affordability as well. What explain that a little bit. Is it necessary in your mind to have subsidies to make insurance more affordable going along with a mandate?
I think of mandates as part of a three-pronged strategy. First, you absolutely have to make the market more organized and work better. Rules can make markets work better. and you have to have subsidies for the low income. If you don't have subsidies for the low income, only a draconian tyrant would impose a mandate. So if you don't have a willingness to subsidize the low income, you should never go down the mandate road. What I'm so heartened by in the campaign and the larger public discussion is how many folks think it's about time we are willing to pony up and subsidize our fellow man to make our system more efficient and more fair.
And let me sort of just to wrap this up. And you also talked about making markets work. So would that involve, let's say, rules that would require insurers to take all comers, prohibit premium surcharges for people who are sick?
That's right. You would require them to accept all comers, and that enables everyone to buy on a level playing field. And, I mean, in my ideal world, I would have age ratings, so you would charge me, 50-something, a great deal more than Sherry's grad students. But I certainly think it's not smart to charge people more because of their health conditions. And so you'd have something like modified community rating, and that would be fundamentally essential to making the market more fair.
Well, Sherry looked a little worried here that you were going to compare your age to her age, I think. But
her grad student.
Michael Ken, let me turn to you as an opponent of mandates. And the Cato Institute has in their tagline individual liberty, so I guess it's not a huge surprise that you wouldn't be enormously fond of government mandates. But getting beyond the philosophical considerations, however important they are, let me talk about some of the more pragmatic issues you've raised in some of what you've written about how a mandate would work or some of the barriers to making a mandate work. Give us a sense of what some of those barriers are. I mean, what are some of the difficulties in implementing a mandate, or what would be some of your concerns in going that direction?
Well, interestingly, about the philosophical point, there really is, although we're opposed on philosophical grounds, there really is no difference between what, say, Governor Romney did in Massachusetts in terms of creating an individual mandate and what the federal government does with the tax exclusion for employer-sponsored insurance. In both cases, either you buy insurance or you pay effectively higher taxes. And so you could say that line has already been breached. But with regard to how individual mandates would operate and what they would achieve, I think there are three principal problems. One is that the problem that individual mandates purport to fix is just not very big, the free rider problem. The second problem is that an individual mandate will not get supporters where they want to go, which is to universal coverage. And third, supporters of individual mandates and universal coverage really shouldn't want that if what they want is to improve health outcomes in the United States.
Let's come back to those. So take the first issue about free riders, that you say that problem is not very large. How do you define this issue of free riders? There are many definitions out there of who would constitute a free rider in a voluntary system.
I think the definition that I use is the one that John Holohan and Jack Hadley of the Urban Institute used in their recent, I think it's a year or two old, Health Affairs article on uncompensated care in the U.S., and what they found is that only 2.8% of health spending goes toward uncompensated care for the uninsured. So you compare that, what's essentially 3% problem, to the much larger problems that we have in our healthcare sector, like 30% of spending goes toward care that doesn't make people any healthier or happier. I think that waste, then, is a much bigger problem than the free rider problem. Plus, even if an individual mandate did work, there's another 1.2% of health spending that is uncompensated care that's given to people who do have health insurance. So even if an individual mandate were able to cover everyone, even some people with health insurance don't pay their bills, and so that wouldn't eliminate the free rider problem.
So in this sense, free rider is what Len was talking about the hidden tax on people with insurance from having uninsured.
That's another interesting aspect of this question. Is it a hidden tax, and to what extent are free riders a hidden tax on those with health insurance? To some extent, they certainly are. Those costs have to be passed on to someone somehow. But there was an article in the most recent issue of the Journal of Health Economics by Jonathan Gruber and a colleague that said that if you look at physicians and how much money they get from the uninsured, and you look at how much they lose to the uninsured who don't pay and how much they make off the uninsured who do pay, because they charge the uninsured who do pay so much more than they charge private insurers, that on balance they make more off the uninsured than they do off of privately insured or insured patients, even when you include the free riders among the uninsured. So if someone is paying for the cost of those uninsured free riders, then it seems to be the other uninsured people, the people who do pay their bills.
At least in the case of physicians.
In the case of physicians, yeah.
You also said that you didn't think for someone who would aim for universal coverage that a mandate would not actually get there. Why is that?
Well, there are a number of reasons, and Sherry has written a lot about these. Take what's happening in Massachusetts. A lot of people are just not going to comply with the mandate because they're because they're ornery. Other people are going to not comply with the mandate because they can't afford it. And even in Massachusetts, one of the things that's happened in Massachusetts is that they've decided to exempt a number of Massachusetts residents from the mandate because those people can't afford it and because the state is not willing to cough up the money necessary to give them the subsidies that would allow them to afford that. So I think that it's possible that an individual mandate could achieve 100% coverage or something very close to that. But by the time the state enacted the sorts of penalties, the sorts of penalties that would be required and the higher taxes that would be required in order to subsidize people to encourage them, I don't think that there is a political will in really any of the states to support that. Certainly there wasn't in California, and there isn't even in Massachusetts, which is a much more left-leaning state.
And do you think, you talked about these subsidies, and there are some who have advocated starting with subsidies, making coverage more affordable, see if that expands coverage to at or near universal coverage. Is that an approach you would go?
I don't think so, and that gets really to my second objection to individual mandates, which is, suppose we have a given amount of money, these subsidies that you're talking about, and we're trying to figure out how we're going to best improve health outcomes with that money. There's no evidence, and economists who have looked at this have said there's no evidence, none, that spending that money on health insurance will get us better outcomes than spending it on nutrition education programs or clinics.
Better health outcomes.
Other expenditures that can affect health. They even raise education as a possibility because there's such a close link between education and health outcomes. So if we don't have any evidence that health insurance, that spending that money on health insurance is going to get us about the best health outcomes, and yet we've already decided that what we want is universal coverage, then what we're essentially saying is we're not trying to maximize health. We are trying to maximize something else. And what that something else is, I think, is an interesting question.
Well, Sherry, let me bring you in. Keying off of Michael's last point, is expanding health insurance the right aim here?
I think expanding health insurance is the right aim, but I'm not sure that expanding health insurance is necessarily the best way to improve health outcomes. If that were the only thing we were looking for, there are many different strategies we could follow, but I think expanding health insurance brings with it a bunch of other benefits besides improving health outcomes that we might care about.
A mandate on the scale that, let's say, Len talked about is unprecedented, at least in the health insurance realm in the U.S., but you've looked at what some other countries have done, let's say Netherlands, and Switzerland. What are some of the experiences of what the process they've gone through and the results they've achieved for the debate here?
Well, I think what's striking there are many lessons we can learn from the Netherlands and Switzerland. I think the first thing is that they started off with very high levels of coverage before they implemented any sort of mandate. So the mandate was not the tool that got them from 85% coverage to 100% coverage. It was a tool that came into play when they were already at about 95, 96, 97% coverage. And in fact, interestingly, neither country has done much to actually enforce the mandate so far, although it already appears to have had an effect on coverage. So I think there is a certain effect of simply saying that it is a mandate without actually the cost-benefit analysis being done by the individual person that says something about prioritization. And I think that can be helpful.
So in other words, just require some people will actually follow the rules even if you don't have penalties to make them follow the rules.
Well, one of the things that strikes me in the debate about mandates is that people think of it as either people making a cost-benefit calculation or kind of ornery people, libertarians, who just don't approve of mandates. The group that I'm actually struck by are the people I think of as negligent procrastinators. It's not that they don't want to comply with the mandate. It's not that they've done the cost-benefit calculation. It's just that they have a big pile of stuff on their in-mail box, and they haven't done anything with any of it. And one of the things that mandates might help us achieve is to move things through up the priority list. At the same time, I would note that neither the Netherlands, North Switzerland has achieved 100% coverage. There's clearly still people who have fallen by the wayside, even with the mandate and the subsidies in place. And, you know, it's a question of minimizing the size of that population and not eliminating it altogether.
And you also talked about, you know, some number of people or some people talking about people making this kind of cost-benefit analysis, which is certainly a natural way for economists to look at this. You've looked at mandates in other realms,
right.
I mean, outside of healthcare. What are, if you're assuming that people are making some kind of cost-benefit analysis, what are some of the features of mandates that either make them work well or make them work poorly?
Well, I think as in many other areas of mandates and enforcement, it's really important that people think that there's a high probability that they'll be caught, which means the enforcement mechanism has to be very systematic, very regular, very routine. It's not a question of making the penalties enormous. If we make the penalties enormous, they will never be enforced. No judge is going to throw someone in jail for not having health insurance. It's just not going to happen. The penalties have to be proportionate, but people have to believe that if they don't buy coverage, then within a certain amount of time, someone's going to catch up with them.
And how about, are the penalties just financial in this case, or are there other kind of costs that are incurred?
I think one important aspect of the cost-benefit analysis that I think we have to think about is how easy it is and how inexpensive and administratively simple it is to comply with the mandate. If it's complicated and difficult and onerous, people will not comply, and that's the way the cost-benefit calculation will work out. Not only money versus money, but how much difficulty, how simple is it to go along with this mandate?
And do subsidies figure in? I mean, the kind of subsidies Len was talking about figure into
that calculation? Clearly, if people can't afford to buy the coverage, they're not, you know, they're willing to take a risk that they're going to get caught and pay the penalty. So I think it is very important that the subsidy level be adequate.
We've gotten tons of emails on this topic, so we clearly hit a nerve, and I want to turn to some of those as well. And people watching can also call in to ask questions, and just remind you, the number is 1-888-KAISER-8, 1-888-524-7378. And let me turn to the first email question, and it keys off this issue we've been talking about free riders, how big this pool of free riders is, what are free riders, what do we think of as free riders? And Len, let me bring you back in. This is a question that asks, is there economic data on how many people elect not to have health insurance but end up bankrupt due to medical expenses or with severe injuries, which is maybe a fairly narrow definition of who the free rider pool is. But let me ask you first the same question I asked Michael. How do you define this group of free riders who would be outside of the system if not for a mandate?
Well, I think we want to think about the free rider population distinct from the total problem of uncompensated care being shifted to us. I would consider a free rider someone who has the financial means to afford health insurance as we all think about it and chooses not to buy it on a voluntary basis. I would put that at most 20% of the population of the uninsured. But I think that the number of people who end up imposing costs on the system is much larger than that. They don't go bankrupt because the hospitals don't end up chasing them down and taking their money. They don't go bankrupt because they shift the cost to the rest of us. Michael talked about 3% of total health spending, but if that all gets shifted to the private premiums, that's about 10% of premium, which is pretty much what reasonable estimates are of what the cost shift really is. It varies by different states. California's higher than Massachusetts and so forth because they have more uninsured. But the uncompensated care problem is bigger than the free riders. The free rider thing is really, in my view, part of bridging the gap around where we are today to really shared responsibility for use of our healthcare resources. It's making people pay their fair share. That's why you want to force them to come in. And I would certainly agree with Sherry that we're never going to get to 100%. You know, Idaho exists, but I think it's likely that we could get into high 90s, and that would minimize the problem so sufficiently that we could then turn to making our health outcomes better. I would like to just point out, I think there are a great deal of studies on the health impact of health insurance. Institute of Medicine, the American Cancer Society makes it abundantly clear you're diagnosed late if you're not insured. You've got a much higher likelihood of dying. Institute of Medicine estimates 18,000 people die every year from absence of health insurance, which will enable them to get routine care. So I don't think it's correct to leave the listeners with an impression that there's no health benefit from health insurance. Whether or not we could get more health benefit in improving education is a very interesting question, but I think we want to make it clear there's a health gain from health insurance as well.
Well, I want to continue on in this free rider theme, but I want to give Michael a chance to respond. I mean, do you buy the studies Len refers to in terms of the
no,
effects
of health insurance? No, I do, and Len raises an important point, which is that there is a health benefit to health insurance. My point was different, though. It is that worth the cost, or could we be getting greater improvements in health for if we use the same money in different ways? And a study or a review of the literature that was published in a book by the Urban Institute found that, in fact, no, there is no evidence that health insurance is the best way to do that. The health effects of health insurance are very real. A lot of people do die because they don't have health insurance. The Institute of Medicine put that figure at 18,000 people per year. But the Institute of Medicine also estimated that medical errors in hospitals kill 50 to 100,000 people every year. So if we're interested in improving health and saving lives, should covering the uninsured be our top priority, or should reducing medical errors be our top priority? I think we really have to look at what is it that we're trying to achieve, and is this the best and most cost-effective way to do that?
Len, let me come back to you on this free rider issue. And you mentioned this, in terms of uncompensated care, that some number of the currently uninsured do end up getting care. It's not all of them. They don't necessarily get all the care that they may need. We got another question along those lines, connecting to the mandate, that whether if there is an individual mandate, would we be willing to deny care as a penalty or as an enforcement to people who do not comply with the mandate? Would you go that far in terms of a penalty or enforcement?
Oh, I would not, and more importantly, health professionals would never go there, but I think, and that's a good thing, but the question of enforcing the mandate, again, is coming back to collecting our fair share from people, making sure they do pay their fair share, and their fair share may be very low if they're really low income, but if they're high income, they should be required to pay. So the enforcement, in my mind, would always be proportional, as Sherry just said, and it would be financial, not to deny services. For example, one way you might enforce it is to have families be required to prove or to show schools when they enroll their children that their children are indeed insured. You would not send the child home if mom didn't have coverage certificate for the kid, but you would email the appropriate authorities and say, you need to send a letter to this household and figure out why this kid isn't covered, because fundamentally they should be.
And Sherry, would that kind of, denying care for someone who doesn't comply to the mandate fall into the category of an excessive penalty that
clearly it's not going to happen. I mean, there is an old libertarian position. Michael insists it's no longer the universally held position, but there are prominent writers who have suggested that the way to solve the problem of the uninsured is simply to deny care to people. It's just not going to happen. Whether you think it's a good idea or a bad idea, it's an unrealistic one.
And Michael, you're not that kind of libertarian, is that?
Well, if we were willing to deny care to people, we wouldn't have a free rider problem. It would just take care of itself. But we're not. And by and large, our unwillingness to deny care to people is a good thing. Now, it does encourage people to take advantage of that guarantee that we offer. And a lot of libertarians suggest, well, maybe what we should do is try to allow states to experiment with different ways of providing that guarantee instead of having one federal law do that. But I think that by and large it's a good thing. It's a sign that we're a good and decent society that we won't deny care to people. But I think that it's an interesting aspect of this question of free riders and universal coverage. We as a society decide that we won't deny care to people, but we have that preference and we want to express that preference, but we don't want to pay for it. We are insulted that preference of ours actually costs us money, and so we want to force other people to chip in, even if they have objections to buying health insurance, or we do things to make it unnecessarily expensive for them.
Well, what about, Len describes the approach he laid out as shared responsibility, and that's certainly been, it's certainly been described that way in Massachusetts, in California, not entirely successfully. Is that when you say, we're not prepared to pay for it, who's the we? I mean, is it
well,
shared responsibility?
The people who want to live in a society where we don't deny care to people, I think everyone in this room, probably everyone who's listening to this webcast, fits into that category. The question then becomes, we have that preference, we're not going to deny care to people who come into an emergency room bleeding, so what do we do about the cost of that? Well, we I think there is an element of selfishness if we say we want this preference expressed, but we don't want to pay for it. We want other people to pay for it. I think that given that it's only about, well, less than 3% of the cost of healthcare generally, it's not really that big a price that we're paying to begin
with. In terms of the uncompensated care or the shift.
Right.
But Larry,
not compared to the other problems that we face.
Len?
Could I jump in here? I mean, first of all, let me just make it clear. I'm for solving medical errors, too. So let's not assume we only get one shot at the policy bandwagon. But second, it's important to understand that the uncompensated care that we actually record is a reflection of what is shifted to the rest of us. But that does not mean that insurance wouldn't bring much more care to the uninsured. They get, on average, roughly half of what the rest of us get. We know they get it late, et cetera, and inefficiently. But what I'm trying to say is there's a bigger problem here than the 3% of health spending. It is the economic cost we bear as a nation from the premature death, from the prolonged illness, from the lost work days, all that stuff. That same Institute of Medicine study a few years ago concluded that the economic cost that society bears in terms of lost output from all this stuff is roughly equal to, I think at the time in 2001, $65 to $130 billion. Today is probably closer to $90 to $175 billion. Those are dollar figures that are certainly in the ballpark of what it would cost to cover everyone. We're really talking about stewardship of resources here, not just the moral case of helping those who happen to end up in the hospital and happen to get the care they need and happen to shift the cost to the rest of us.
But by the same token, if we lose 2.5 to 5 times as many people to medical errors as we do to the uninsured, what's the economic cost of that? And are we setting our priorities incorrectly because we would get, you know, not only more health, but also fewer economic losses if we were to solve that problem first.
No, I don't think correct to that, but I don't think it's an either or. I think you can do both simultaneously. In fact, I think you have to do both simultaneously to make the system better.
Well, Cherry?
I mean, it's also important to realize that you can only go after the problems you know how to solve. And while I would love to end medical errors, no one has got a clue about how to do that. So, you know, whereas covering the uninsured, whether through taxes or through mandates, is something we have a fairly good idea of how to do if we don't have the money for it. But getting rid of medical errors is the subject of another Kaiser Family panel, and I don't think we really know how to do it.
Well, I think that there are things that can be done, and groups, organizations like Kaiser are doing a lot in that area. The Veterans Administration, with the data they're collecting, they're reducing a lot of medical errors. And I think that, you know, there are a number of components or a number of approaches that would help to reduce medical errors, and some of them are being undertaken right now. But, you know, what's interesting is that a lot of those efforts are resisted by the industry because reducing medical errors actually cuts into, and reducing unnecessary care for that matter, all cuts into earnings for a lot of members of the industry. And so what's one of the interesting ironies of covering the uninsured is there will be more people who are covered. We will also spend a lot more money on medical care. And insofar as we are increasing the earnings of the industry, we're increasing their ability to fight these much larger problems that we face.
Maybe we should make a deal with them. We'll cover the uninsured if you'll take a cut on the medical
care. Well, you know what? That would probably be an improvement on balance.
It would be
a tough bargain to strike.
But I think we'll end this with everyone agreeing that we should deal with medical errors at a minimum. I want to come back to the topic at hand. And focus in a little bit on some of the design aspects of an individual mandate and some of the trade-offs that might require. And we got actually a number of questions about the benefits that a required package would include. And mandating something requires you to decide what those are. And they actually came on sort of across the spectrum. One set of emails talking about, you know, if a mandate required someone to have a plan with a $1,000 deductible, that's way too high in terms of out-of-pocket costs for people to afford. On the other hand, how can we can a mandate work when there are all these state insurance mandates that require more comprehensive coverage? Len, let me start with you. You're as the proponent. How do you think about that trade-off? I mean, what is the kind of minimum level of benefits that, or how do we think about the minimum level of benefits that people would be mandated to have?
Well, first of all, I would certainly say that ultimately that is a political, social values question. And my observation in our nation is that views of that vary with geography and obviously the economic and social conditions of a place. So Massachusetts will have a very different view about what's minimally acceptable than Utah, for example. And in my ideal world, that's okay. I think you would allow a fair bit of flexibility. You probably would want a minimum national floor, but that minimum national floor might be something, that would be pegged probably to the federal employees thing, not to necessarily have that, but to say that's a standard we can all count and agree on and compute the value of. You might say 80% of that, and then you allow the private insurance industry to come up with different packages to meet that actuarial value target, and then you allow Congress agrees and so forth, and people think that's smart, you allow different states to move that thing up or down. And to me, that's a much smarter way to let local values and abilities to pay reflect in the policy design. The trade-off you face, which is fairly severe, is the more generous you are in demanding that the package cover XYZ, the greater your subsidy costs are going to have to be, and the higher up the income scale you're going to have to subsidize people to make it truly affordable. So what I tend to think of is requiring a parsimonious package, but make that parsimonious package, you know, decent, and make the cost sharing that goes with it's got to be considered as well. You don't want to have, as because the emailer suggests, you don't want to have poor people facing really high cost sharing, otherwise you defeat the whole purpose. But you don't want to go too high up the income scale, so you want to think about what is the package I would require someone to buy that would give clinical value that they should be able to buy unsubsidized. That's the way to think about the package.
Sure, does that sound right to you? How do you think about this?
I think that there are different pieces of this package that we could imagine. One is the piece that has to do with the free rider problem, and I think it's not only, and Len alluded to this at the beginning, I don't think it's simply the fact that people are free riding on emergency rooms or whatever. I think it also has an effect on the way the individual market functions altogether, that some people are not in it. And it has an effect on how the sales of insurance have to work. If everyone's buying coverage and the choice is which plan, that's a different market than one in which some people have to be persuaded that they want to buy coverage in the first place. So, I mean, I think there's that whole component that we want to think about. And that is something that we think everybody ought to do because it's their civic responsibility. We're already paying for them one way or another. If we want to make the package more generous than that, we are basically telling people that they're going to have to spend their own money in a way that we think is right for them for other reasons. And I think that it is only appropriate for us to do that if we're willing to pay the taxes to make it possible. So I think from a pure free rider perspective, a fairly high deductible, fairly parsimonious plan that didn't actually have much in it at all would be kind of the piece that fits with this. And then you would engage people with the market and let them pick whatever they like. If you want them to have more coverage because it could provide health benefits or whatever, you better be prepared to pay the subsidies.
Well, let me start with the first thing you talked about, but in terms of making the market work, and Len certainly referred to this earlier. What if you could take a second to explain why let's say an individual mandate might be necessary in order to make an insurance market or the non-group insurance market in particular work.
Well, I think there's a couple of things we know. One is employer-sponsored insurance is way cheaper than individual insurance. And you ask yourself, well, why is that the case? I think there are two reasons that it's the case and that are important to keep in mind. First of all, the selling costs are trivially small in the employer market. Once your employer has signed on, it costs very little for you to sign up anymore. It's right in your face. So there's no selling cost at that point. And second, there's a naturally formed group that in which even healthy people are forced to participate. The individual market has neither of those features. Every person has to be sold their coverage, and they have to be persuaded to maintain their coverage, and so the selling cost is very high. And moreover, if you're very healthy and coverage costs go up, you're likely to drop out. So I think one of the pros of a mandate is to say we're going to take those two things off the table. And I think that's part of the reason, interestingly, that other countries that run universal systems with a lot of different health insurance plans, a lot of sickness funds or whatever, have much lower administrative costs than we do, despite having a multitude of plans. Because although they have many plans, the plans don't have to actually sell coverage. They just have to compete amongst themselves for who gets this person.
And Michael, I mean, is this the use of a mandate in order to make the insurance market, the non-group insurance market function? I mean, is that a persuasive argument for you?
No, there's a point that was you were discussing before that I wanted to comment on. It has to do with defining what we're mandating. If you require a certain behavior on the part of the citizenry, you have to tell them what that is. So you have to say you got to buy insurance. You have to tell them what insurance means. And we would, you know, it would be nice for we philosopher kings, Sherry and Len and me and you, to come up with a reasonable definition of what that insurance package is going to look like. And we could all agree on it, and there would be some fairness to it, but we don't control these things. The people who are going to control what goes into that package are members of Congress and the special interest groups, the providers who will benefit financially from having a broader package. So what you see when, I mean, we see this at the state level when there isn't a mandate to buy individual or to buy insurance. Providers go to the legislature and they say, we want these services covered. We want our the chiropractors and others say, we want our services covered because that expands the market for their services and increases their incomes. And we can expect to see the same thing happen at the federal level. Even if Congress begins with a very low minimum, the pressure is going to be there to increase the amount of coverage, and that, you know, that's going to make the mandate that much harder to comply with, and it's going to there's that. So I think that it's important to keep in mind that that is the dynamic that's going to take over any definition of what is covered in the mandate. And in fact, you know, one thing that happened in Massachusetts was a lot of people who had coverage that they were, by, you know, as far as we know, very happy with, we're told by the Commonwealth that, no, the coverage you have is not comprehensive enough. You have to buy more coverage in order to satisfy the mandate. So even though preferences vary by geography, including, you know, from your house to your neighbor's house, those preferences are going to be overruled by any mandate. Now, about the using mandates or other rules to make individual markets work, I think that the non-group health insurance market doesn't get enough respect. And the reason is that research by Mark Pauley and his colleagues from the University of Pennsylvania and by scholars at the at Brand find that there's a lot of pooling that happens in the individual insurance market. Sherry identified one of the problems, which is over time there are incentives for that pooling to maybe unravel, and Kaiser has done some work on that. But you have to ask, compared to what? In the employer-based market, there are a lot of risks that don't get pooled. The risks that you are going to lose your job and lose your coverage when that happens. The risk that your employer isn't going to offer coverage. So I think that there's a lot of pooling that happens in the individual market. We have to recognize that. And true, the administrative costs are much higher in the individual market, but I think that with a level playing field between the two, group and non-group coverage, the administrative costs would probably fall in a thicker individual market.
Well, sure. Let me bring you back in. First, sticking on the topic of the individual market, I mean, what do you make of let's say Mark Pauley's arguments that there is a substantial amount of pooling that does now happen, and is that sufficient?
The individual market is a residual market in almost all places in the United States. Most people who are in it for a very brief time. So it's a little hard to know exactly in large data sets how much pooling is going on. I mean, I think Mark's work is good, but we are not actually observing people over any lengthy period of time, and we don't really know. As to the question of whether administrative costs would fall, we've actually looked at places and states in which the individual market is relatively thick, and we don't find any real advantages in terms of premiums in those places compared to places where the market is thinner. So if you look at some of the Midwestern states where the individual market is historically richer than it, thicker, has a lot more people in it, they don't actually have lower premiums even though there are more people in the market. The inherent costs are just there. And one thing that we might hope with the mandate is that we could bring those costs down and make that market more inherently competitive.
But if I could just jump in, since I'm the only person that's actually written a paper with Mark Pauley on these questions, we jointly published a paper about the individual market a few years ago. I think what we concluded was very clear. It does work for some people, maybe even a majority of human beings, but it doesn't work, and it can never work as it's currently constructed for the people who have health conditions who are the ones in most need of health insurance, for the simple reason that the insurers who sell there are not charities. They can't be expected to subsidize those kinds of risks out of their own profits. So they're going to always try to figure out a way to restrict the sick's access to their products. So a mandate alone won't even solve the problem. You've got to change the way the rating happens. You've got to change. You've got to have the rules. And what I'm trying to say, the mandate enables you to change the rules in a way that maintains a viable business proposition for the insurance companies. But I will say the fundamental thrust and goal and indeed dream of those of us who advocate mandates and advocate trying to actually get most Americans, if not all, covered, is to turn that insurance value proposition from risk selection, which will always work for the healthy, who, thank God, are most of us in any given day, but to turn the value proposition from risk selection into delivering clinical value per dollar, and let's increase value per dollar. It's interesting, the companies that actually see how they could manage care and do a better job of selecting providers and imposing or using the right protocols, et cetera, to get more clinical value per dollar, those people are perfectly comfortable, and those are the ones with the mandate and with the rules we're talking about, and those are the ones that supported, for example, the reforms in California, Kaiser, Blue Shield of California, Health Net, so forth. The ones who oppose these kinds of rules are the people who only make money selecting risk. They're the ones for whom the business model they're in is, in my view, antiquated and needs to be erased. They should sell their book of business to those people who can manage care, or they should learn to do it themselves. But, you know, we stopped child labor, we stopped slavery, we ought to stop extreme risk selection, too.
Michael?
Well, what Lynn said about insurers not offering coverage or not the individual market not covering people with high-cost conditions is correct, but with this one caveat. They don't cover high-cost conditions if you show up and try to purchase health insurance when you have a high-cost condition. Obviously, they're not charities. They can't do that. But if you buy insurance when you're healthy and you develop a high-cost condition, then you get to keep the insurance that you have. It does appear that they are covering people with a lot of people with high-cost conditions. And really, when you think about it, that is the market's way of preventing people from being free riders, from waiting until they have a high-cost condition and then buying health insurance, as opposed to instead of paying money into that pool all along so that you can help others who need the help. If the market allowed people to wait until they were sick, then it would essentially be allowing them to free ride.
Isn't that the problem, the mandate? Insofar as
you get people to purchase insurance, yes, it solves that free rider problem. It doesn't solve the entire free rider problem. And again, the free rider problem, I don't think is that big, but you also create all sorts of other problems. One of them is healthcare spending is going to explode for a number of reasons, one of which is, I mentioned, the pressure, the influence that providers are going to have on the minimum benefits package. But also, most of the, and I think Len has mentioned adding community rating or price controls on health insurance to sort of level premiums between healthy and sick. The problem with that, with those laws, is they increase the amount of insurance that sicker people purchase and lead to more consumption, which increases healthcare spending overall. So while we're trying to solve the 3% problem, we're going to make our 30% problem of waste in our system that much worse.
Well, I want to come back to price controls because we actually have some emails about that. But, Len, let me just come back to you to close this out. And just if you could describe what you have in mind for the kinds of rating reforms you would imagine in a mandated system.
Well, I would certainly think there's got to be a guaranteed issue. You have to sell to all comers. You would probably restrict the variance in premium across individuals. Pure community rating is a goal of some people. It's not mine. I've read Mark Pauly's early work. I understand he's probably better and smarter than the insurance people that I know in real life all feel fairly comfortable with age rating as a good proxy for allowing it to breed, but and basically trying to minimize what you require the healthy young immortals to have to pay. But don't allow health status rating so you remove the incentive to do the underwriting, which is what drives up the cost of insurance in the individual market. And that's why Sherry's result, that there's no real difference across states where it's bigger or larger. It's all because of the rating they're doing now, the underwriting they're doing now. So age rating, guaranteed issue, and, guaranteed renewal and so forth.
I do want to come back to this issue of price control since Michael brought it up and we have had several emails on it. I'll read one. In order for any healthcare proposal to work, doesn't there have to be some sort of cap or maximum on the rising cost of healthcare? And this is an issue that's come up in the debate in California as well, that if we're going to mandate people into the into a private insurance system, then should the government play a role in regulating the premiums that those private insurers are paying, since it's now a mandatory product? Sherry, let me let you answer that however you want, but I'm particularly interested in you're looking at some of the other countries like Netherlands and the Switzerland, whether there's any or other realms where there are mandates. Does it then or is it paired with some kind of government regulation of what those insurers can charge?
I think in some cases it is, but in many cases it's not. So I don't think that there's a uniform answer to that question. I think that the key here, and I guess it goes back to the point that Michael made right at the very beginning, is that if we want to provide coverage to people, the government's going to have to force somebody to do something that they didn't want to do at some point. They're either going to have to force them to pay taxes that they didn't want to pay or force us to pay for our own coverage through a mandate. And I think the real danger with a mandate that people are aware of is that we might mandate people to buy things that they can't then afford. And we might become the tyrants that Len describes simply by inadvertence or being budget conscious or whatever. And so I think that the trick is not so much controlling the prices, because I think that's not going to work in the long run. We know it doesn't work in the long run. We have no really good ways to do it. The trick is making sure that the subsidies and the mandate are interlinked in a way that really holds. Making the mandate contingent on the subsidy, for example, would I think satisfy me on that count. And I think would probably help the legislatures to combat the provider pressure that at this point has no counterpart in most of the state budget discussions. So I think that's really where the price containment piece has to go in. It has to go in on the level of, we're not going to expand the benefits, we're not going to do all this good stuff because we're going to have to pay, we the legislature are going to have to pay for it in the subsidy money. I don't think that containing the cost, I mean, we've seen it in car insurance. So we have car insurance mandates and some states go and try and legislate the price of car insurance. Doesn't really work very well in the long run.
And let me also, not unrelated to this, we've also gotten many emails on the topic of a single payer system. I don't feel like I can leave the hour without asking about it. And I'll read one of them. Instead of requiring individuals to purchase individual coverage that they truly can't afford, wouldn't it be better to establish a single universal risk pool, equitably funded based on ability to pay? And Michael, let me start with you. I'm assuming because you're an advocate of single payer, but how, in your view, what is the difference between an individual mandate for private insurance and a single payer system?
Well, not much. I think the reason for that is in the single payer system, the government taxes you, takes your money, and then it gives you the health care. It tells you what kind of health care you're going to get. In a system with an individual mandate, the government lets you keep your money, but it tells you how to spend it and tells you what to spend it on and what kind of health care you're going to get. So who makes the decisions doesn't change. It's still the government making the decisions. I think the difference has to do with, and this might explain why a lot on the left prefer single payer, the difference is that it's administered by private companies who are going to be making a lot of money off of the taxpayers, who are going to be able to lobby the government to increase their, for policies that are going to increase their earnings. And that's a reason why I oppose an individual mandate as well. I just, oppose it and would rather see us move in the opposite direction of the government taking less of your money and letting workers decide what to spend their money on rather than mandates.
And Len, let me ask you the same question. What in your mind are let's say the similarities between an individual mandate and a single payer system, and what are the important differences in your view?
It's really interesting in the way the emailer or the caller put it in the language was they would rather have a sliding scale where basically payment was based upon ability to pay, and they think that's only achievable in a single payer system. I think that's achievable in an individual mandate system, and we could do it all in private. With private markets, I think fundamentally the issue about what the differences are have to do with on the supply side. The financing is not going to look that different whether it's a blue card or a green card or a red card. The supply side is where it really matters. A single payer system turns physicians, clinicians into employees of the government. And Michael's right, that would give the government far more control over what actually happened, whereas an individual-based market system would allow a lot of creativity and innovation to occur, and Lord knows there's waste out there now, and we want to do a whole lot better about buying smarter and reducing that waste, but I I would fear the price control temptation would be too great with a single payer system, at least in the short run, until we get far better at buying smarter. So I would rather have the system breed and be a little inefficient, frankly, but preserve the choice that I think most Americans and certainly most clinicians would feel more comfortable with. You know, I think in the long run, the single payer system would lower administrative costs at the expense of creativity and innovation in product and service delivery, and in the short run, the private system would give you more of that, but it's going to cost more.
Michael, do you want
to? I'll pass.
I don't know. Relative to a bicycle, a Mini Cooper and a Hummer are both cars. But that doesn't mean that if you were looking at, if you were in the market for a car, a Mini Cooper and a Hummer would look the same. So I'm not convinced that a single payer system and an individual mandate really translate into the same thing. But I think that the devil is in the details. The question is how we design the mandate, who is subject to the mandate, you know, where the mandate level is going to be set, and what the politics of that are likely to be. And my guess is the politics of a mandate are likely to set the mandate somewhere around, even if the provider groups are as powerful as you'd like them to be, the 30th or 40th percentile of the health insurance distribution. Right.
So that means, let's say, 30% of people have coverage that's less comprehensive today, 70%
more comprehensive. Because everyone knows that the subsidies have to come out of their pockets. That means that at least 70% of the insured population is going to be in a very different environment than a single payer system. So, you know, would it be better to go to a single payer system? It's a long debate. We could talk about that at another session as well.
Could.
But the idea that these are the same thing, I think, is misleading.
And how about on the financing side? I mean, Len talked about the potential for an individual mandate system to move towards a more progressive financing structure like most single payer systems. Is it?
You know, I think one of the mistakes we make in this country is to believe that healthcare reform is something that you do once. Countries that have actually done it realize that it's something you do every 3 years. And that is going to be the case no matter how we move forward here. So which way we'll go, I can't say. We have to take the first step first.
But I would also say if you look at the subsidy schedule put in place in Massachusetts, you look at the one proposed in California, and you look at the one proposed in Congress right now, the one live concrete proposal that has bipartisan support is the Wyden-Bennett bill. There you see progressive subsidy structures. Maybe not ideal. I certainly agree with Sherry. We revisit not every 3 years, every year we'll be talking about something on it. But you can certainly begin and tweak it to fit your preferences over time, how progressive you want it to be.
I think it's important when every policy tool we talk about, we should be considering trade-offs. The trade-offs involved, and I think an interesting trade-off involved with the progressive subsidy scale is that those sorts of subsidies that disappear as your income increases or that gets smaller and eventually disappears as your income increases, they created disincentive for you to earn and increase your income. So if you look at all of the programs that are available to a single mother of two living in New Mexico, and that includes Medicaid, SCHIP, housing subsidies, child care subsidies, TANF, food stamps, and so on, and say that single mother of two is making $15,000 a year. If by some miracle she was able to increase her income from her earnings from $15,000 a year to $45,000 a year, effectively triple them, you would think that she would be better off because she would have $30,000 of additional earnings. In fact, she would be no better off financially because she would lose $4,000 to taxes, and then she would lose $26,000 of government benefits. So her marginal effective tax rate is 100%, and she has very little financial incentive to climb the economic ladder. If we layer even more sliding scale subsidies on top of that, then we're going to be creating even more substantial disincentives for people to climb the economic ladder.
Sure.
I would say, though, a big piece of that difference, and I agree with Michael's math at the moment, is the Medicaid benefit to which she has access now, which she would lose. That's because right now it's a binary thing. You either go off the cliff and lose it completely, or you have it completely, a sliding scale like we're all talking about, would significantly reduce the contribution of disincentive of the health insurance scheme we're talking about.
Actually, I have to disagree with you there, Len, because it would not. If the subsidy disappears as a result of her increasing her earnings, then you can spread out that disincentive. And that's why I actually picked a very long window with from $15,000 to $45,000 per year. That disincentive always exists, and you can't erase it with a phase-out period.
You can extend it,
and it'll become more expensive.
I employ janitors, and if I offered them a triple salary increase, even though they would lose a bunch of benefits, I can't imagine anyone turning this down. And we can write about these disincentives, and we can model the disincentives, but the actual impact, when people look at it, John Gruber's done some nice work on this, and the economic impact of phase-out disincentives on people's behavior is very small. That it's not something we should be losing sleep over. We should do what's fair and right and try and think it through as best as we can, but the alternative is just to leave everyone on their own bottom, because that's what gives you the strongest incentives, and I don't think that would be a fair society in which to live.
Well, we're approaching the end of the hour, so I want to turn to a couple final questions. And, you know, while we're on the question of mandates, we also got questions on not just an individual mandate, but an employer mandate, which also could be a topic for another show. But Len, I just wanted to turn to you as the proponent on the panel of individual mandates. How do you see an employer requirement fitting in here?
Well, I certainly, when I think of the 21st century economy as an economist, as opposed to a health policy analyst, I think we need to figure out a way to reduce our reliance on employer financing. It can't be done overnight. It's going to have to be a transition. But I'm really worried about international competitiveness, and I think we all should be. So I would not like to see new requirements being imposed on employers. It's interesting that a number of different organizations have embraced the individual mandate and approach and willingness to tax ourselves to have subsidies, and they range from the National Business Group on Health this morning to the ERISA Industry Committee, Federation of American Hospitals, the Colorado Business Forum. I'm here in Colorado because a number of business leaders are joining others to advocate covering all Coloradans with an individual mandate here tomorrow, but they all oppose requiring employers to pay more. It's not necessary. It's fundamentally a financing question. And when you think about it, the employers who voluntarily provide it today basically would be expected to continue doing it in a new regime. The ones who don't provide it today are pretty much low-wage firms. Taxing low-wage firms, first of all, there's not a whole lot of money there. And second, you end up taxing low-wage workers. I'm not sure that's the smartest way to expand coverage. So for my money, it's smarter to come up with alternative financing schemes. But for a lot of people, it is the simplest one. And for some people, it's a concept of gross fairness to require employers to, quote, pay their fair share as well. So it's not my preferred option. I could live with it if that's what Congress thinks we have to do.
Well, speaking of Congress, I want to wrap up the hour with a final question from an emailer in Washington, which is, if we look at the case of the mandate in Massachusetts as a case study, what caveats should we be aware of in terms of how a similar health reform package would play out on a national level? And I want to give each of you an opportunity to think about this real-life experiment in Massachusetts and what some of the lessons of that experience, both the passage of the bill, the implementation of the bill, mean for a potential similar debate nationally. Michael, let me start with you.
Lessons to be drawn from Massachusetts. I think there are a number of them. One, an individual mandate won't cover everyone. Number two, when you pass an individual mandate, there's going to be a lot of rent seeking by employers. Employers, but also mainly by providers to increase the amount of coverage that people have to purchase, because that increases the provider's incomes. Three, you usually don't get, or we didn't in Massachusetts get this kind of reform until Massachusetts faced the prospect of losing federal funds. So what that means is it even speaks more to the point that it was that the body politic, at least in Massachusetts, didn't have the appetite for coming up with the subsidies necessary to achieve universal coverage. It was only because there was $380 million that the feds were going to take away that that they were able to pass this. And then finally, in the wake of California, because the reform effort appears to have failed there, a lot of people are saying, well, the federal government has to take over and reform health care. I think there's a lesson to be learned about on that question from Massachusetts, which is because that money, that $380 million was really, and the possible loss of that money was really the impetus for enacting this reform. It shows the danger of moving that having the federal government provide those subsidies. And most people want to do that because the feds don't have to balance their budget. And what that really means is that I think Massachusetts highlights the danger that we might try to achieve some large-scale healthcare reform by deficit spending at the federal level, which is a way of getting around the body politics resistance to the higher taxes that would be involved by pushing those taxes off onto future generations. So I think there's that danger as well.
Sherry?
Well, if it's only $380 million, that's really cheap. We could get universal coverage in America for $20 billion, right? If I multiply correctly.
If that's all the
federal money that it takes to make all the states move, it would be a lovely outcome.
But it wasn't.
Well, I do think that does suggest moving ahead through some mixture of federal and state action is probably the best way to go. And that may be the lesson of Massachusetts. There's a lot of diversity in the country. The federal government certainly has a role, but whether the role is to run the whole system or whether the role is to enable reform at different levels, whether through deficit spending or bribery, is a question. I think we have to watch Massachusetts before we can learn lessons.
And Len, you get the final word here.
Okay. Well, first I would say over 300,000 people have coverage that didn't have it last year, and most people in Massachusetts have been surprised at how many signed up, and I happen to have been at a dinner with the former lieutenant governor, who was a big fan of Mitt Romney, who thinks it's a great success, as well as I know John McDonough, who's a strong advocate for health care for all in Massachusetts, thinks it's a great success. So you've got a pretty wide spectrum of folks in Massachusetts who think it is a success. It's not perfect. We're going to have to fix various dimensions of it, et cetera. The lessons for the larger countries debate, I would submit, are two. One, you had a bipartisan agreement. You had a Republican presidential aspirant willing to use the word all, a Democratic legislature, a very liberal one willing to accept the word limit. Out of that combination, you can make a compromise to work. And then the bigger one, the second one, is that I think it's unambiguously true that we have to think about this as a society. We are one community, and one community may decide we're willing to spend this much this year, and then we'll look at the facts and decide how much we're willing to spend next year. They'll have to continually revisit the subsidy structure and the amount of money they're offering to pay for it. And Michael's right, we have to be mindful of the long-run cost of this, but that's precisely why you want to do delivery system reform and get those errors out and get the waste out simultaneously with expanding coverage so we can make it sustainable for us all.
So any package should have that included in it. I have you on record.
Everything you see me write, Michael, will always have it there. And by the way, most candidates have it there too.
Well, we end on a note of consensus. I'm Larry Levitt, and you've been watching KaiserNetwork.org. Thanks to our panel of experts, and thanks to you for joining us. We'll see you next time for Ask the Experts.